My very special guest today is none other than the famous filmmaker Chris Everard. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hello, Vinny. It's nice to be with you.
It's a stellar opportunity that we have in front of us here, and by us, I mean me, to interview you. Now, if you would be so kind as to fill out the first part of the interview here by explaining your website to people and who you are and what it is you do.
Right. Well, I wrote my first book in 1984. I really basically can't remember the first time when I was interested in esoteric, spiritual, and extraterrestrial subjects. I mean, it goes right the way back to when I was a little boy. Maybe I was about 4 or 5 years old. And my grandfather was a member of the Sovereign Military Order of the Knights of Malta, which is a Masonic organization that is linked to MI6 and the Vatican. And when I was growing up as a little boy, we had about 30 or 40 of his medals on the wall at home. And I always asked my mum, what are those medals? And she said, oh, that's when your granddad was in the Royal Air Force. And anyway, I wanted to have a closer look at them. I got a ladder one day when I was on my own, and everyone was at work. I got a step ladder out, and I climbed up the step ladder to have a look at these medals, and there wasn't a single medal there from the Royal Air Force. They were all medals from Masonic organizations that had KOM, Knights of Malta, on them, and they had bull's heads and stars of David and various weird emblems, and it just got me interested. And then my first job, I had a Saturday job at a hi-fi store, and I remember going to this store on the bus, and the bus went past a Masonic temple, and I saw one of these symbols that was on one of my grandfather's medals. And I thought, oh, there's buildings with these symbols on the outside of the building. I was about 12, 13, and that got me interested at a very early age. And I started writing books, and I started publishing my own magazine. And I was publishing articles about the Bavarian Illuminati and different secret societies and brotherhoods on the bulletin board BBS system. That's more or less a kind of early version of the internet. And I built up a magazine publishing business in my spare bedroom, and I sold it to a big publishing company in England. And I invested the money into broadcasting documentaries and TV shows on the internet. And I had a meeting with Apple Computer in 1998. And I told them what I was going to do. And they said, well, we haven't got any technology that allows you to do it yet. And I said, don't worry, I'll get something sorted out and I'll do it myself. And I did. And we started test transmissions in 1998. And my first documentary films were about the secret space program and about crop circles and UFOs. And I made those films. And this is in the days of VHS. There was no DVD in those days. And I built up a mailing list of people that were interested in my research. And in those days, you used to have to email your articles to people because the internet was only running at 28 kilobytes per second. Websites used to take, about 4 or 5 minutes to load each page, and you couldn't have very large images. But through all of that, we managed to get the Enigma channel going, and there's been 10.5 million subscribers since 1999. We were broadcasting video before everyone else, and it was launched at the Royal Television Society in 1999. So that's basically what I do.
Now, it's interesting that you say you published your first book in 1984. That was the year I was born.
Yeah.
It's an ominous year.
Well, because of Orwell, yeah. George Orwell wrote his book in 1948, and he reversed the last two digits. So if he'd written his book a year later, in 1949, it would have ended up being called, you know, that's how he came up with the title 1984.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to work at the BBC, just on and off as a freelance recording engineer. I used to earn money, some friends of mine at school, they ended up working at Abbey Road Studios, owned by EMI. And they got me, you know, various little jobs there. And I used to earn a little bit of money as an audio recording engineer, recording orchestras for film soundtracks.
Yeah, that sounds like quite prestigious work. And are you still operating at that kind of level now? Because I found a lot of people, when they do work in professional industries, but they retain something that a lot of those industries are missing, like a conscience. The work starts to dry up. You start to have to become even more independent. And it becomes not about a choice, but a lack of options.
I've known about the so-called New World Order and brotherhoods and corruption within those networks of brothers for a long time. I've always written articles where I've kind of seeded this information into the articles. I've written more than 1,000 reviews of professional broadcast equipment. And my magazine publishing business used to actually publish a magazine for, you know, television and radio bosses, really, and all the top technical engineers in the broadcast industry worldwide. And so I was always feeding information about the Illuminati into those articles. And, I think the thing is that, my first book was published when I was 19. So I've had independent amounts of money to be able to, you know, broadcast, publish, and now I have, you know, my company that we publish books, we publish magazines, we publish ebooks, we have a radio network, we have a television network, and we have a movie studio. So I'm able to actually not worry about censorship, but I do not like the way that my films are being butchered and mutilated and distorted on video sharing websites. And many people believe that they've seen my films on various video sharing websites. What they've actually seen is they've seen a butchered and censored version of one of my films, because many of the actual files that are out there in the public domain, and I've never, ever uploaded any of my films to any video sharing website, have actually been censored. And it's usually the very last 10 minutes of my documentaries where I sum up everything. And this has led a lot of people astray. And it gives them the wrong end of the stick. And then there's a whole kind of fake author industry of people who, you know, claim various weird career paths and things that don't exist. And they kind of see my films and then they plagiarize the information. And it's like Chinese whispers. And, that's why I don't like video sharing websites, basically.
Well, I think it's a natural reaction to protect your interests, because if your good name is being despoiled by scumbaggery agents of the very people that you're trying to expose, can't leave a sweet taste on the tongue, can it?
Not really, no. Yeah, and, you know, yeah, it's just led people astray. It's not only led the public astray. As I said, it's triggered off this weird kind of gaggle of strange researchers and authors who've got the wrong end of the stick and don't actually understand a lot of what they're talking about.
Well, you say,
you know,
that
their idea of research is watching YouTube videos. My idea of research is traveling the world, and I've taught myself French. I speak quite a lot of Spanish. I've taught myself bits of Latin. I taught myself Sumerian, and you know, like for example, the Nag Hammadi texts, which were found in Egypt, 1947. I actually went to Egypt when there was a bloke sitting outside with a machine gun and a 4-inch thick plate of lead. And it was in the middle of the Spring Revolution, 2011. And I went there specifically to go to the source of the information. And I've also taught myself a little bit of Aramaic as well. If you talk to... And I've interviewed and I've had a lot of these types of people as guests in my documentary films. If you ask them, do you understand, you know, Aramaic or French? Forget it. you know, so unfortunately, that's the situation. I wish that it was a different situation. I wish that there were more people who would go to the source of the information. But they don't seem to do that. They get their information from other people's books.
It becomes, as you rightly put, Chinese whispers.
Yeah.
And I think what is happening globally, we're actually seeing almost a nexus point of these kind of disinformation, misinformation sort of movements. And every single conceivable conspiracy direction you can think of, without anybody knowing any of the truth whatsoever, they believe the lies, because it's a hell of a lot what was it Mark Twain said? It's much easier to convince somebody of a lie than to convince them that they've been lied to.
Oh, that's interesting. I've not heard that quote from him. He also said, if you tell the truth, you don't need to have a script. You don't need to remember anything if you just tell people the truth, which is, you know, there's a lot of truth in there.
Indeed. And what people don't get is the value of raw, unfiltered, straightforward, from the source truth. These are the things that are actually inherently valuable in and of themselves. Everything else, I think, is it's like, you know, when you have your first birthday, you have one candle, then you have two candles, and then you get a little bit older, and you're like, it's actually too much effort to put 40 candles on the cake. What the hell is the point? you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely, it's true. Yeah,
and the thing is, you just look at the fact. You don't need to record it. Oh, it needs to be absolutely so accurate, etc., that nobody can ever argue with it. This is what people are actually thinking, that there is no such thing as objective truth.
Well, it goes further than that. I mean, people are being told that the entire universe, the planet Jupiter, the moon, us, every living creature on our planet does not exist. People are being told that it's a process of your mind. And of course, this tactic of telling people who become disciple kind of followers has been used throughout the ages. It's what all messiahs, it's what all saviors do. It's what everyone in the Edwardian, Georgian, and Victorian eras, when there was an upsurge of interest in the occult teachings of India and the Himalayas, this is what all of those people did. I'm talking about Helena Blavatsky, Ledbetter, Rudolf Steiner, to a certain degree, and lots of the other kind of psychics, fortune tellers, mystics. Gurdjieff is another one. They get to a point where they basically rely on a narrow selection of texts. One of the most popular ones is called the Kybalion. And the Kybalion has a little line in there, which they take literally. And it says, the mind is everything. Well, the mind is obviously an extraordinarily fantastic and potent and amazing phenomenon within the creative force of the universe and creation and evolution. But the mind did not exist before the universe. And I've studied astronomy. I've studied astronomy at the University of Greenwich in London. And, you know, I have a very, very big telescope. I built my own kind of space observatory. And, you know, I use sophisticated astronomical equipment. And I can see with my equipment, you know, detail. I can not only see Jupiter, I can see the moons of Jupiter. And when I see people being told, oh, that's all a figment and it doesn't exist and it's just a perception, I think, well, you know, hang on there, all right? Because the human brain is the product of evolution. And planet Earth is 4.5 billion years old. The universe has been dated back to about 13.7 billion years old. And the human brain in its current form, Homo sapiens sapiens, which is us, Homo erectus, the Neanderthals, Cro-Magnon, has gone through an evolutionary period of time, which we can date back probably 115 to 250,000 years. And that's it. There was no human brain to perceive the existence of our planet, which formed about 4.5 billion years ago.
What I found was disturbing about this line of thought was to say that I can create my reality. And I'm thinking, you can create your entire reality. Really? What do? Cancel out the 700 billion other people, 7 billion other people that are also manifesting their reality? You just cancel them out because you're that powerful?
Well, absolutely. And obviously, you know, when you look through a telescope, you're looking back in time. And when you look at the nearest galaxy to our galaxy, which is the Andromeda galaxy, which, by the way, is on a collision course with our galaxy, and the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy will end up becoming a super galaxy. What you're actually seeing when you look through a big telescope and you're seeing the light of the stars from the Andromeda galaxy is you're seeing light which began its journey long, long, long ago. Some of those photons of light coming down the telescope began their journey when there were dinosaurs walking the Earth. Now, you know, basically, I'm sorry to say this, and you know, a lot of people get very kind of agitated, really, because they've woken up, they've realized that the political class of politicians, the lords, the congressmen, the senators are basically in it for themselves and they're all corrupt and they've woken up to that and that's good. And they've gone through an awakening stage. They've realized that really mainstream news is really a selection of channels for what I describe as neo-fascist propaganda coming from the royal political corporate elite. And they've woken up to that, which is good. But then, as they've woken up from whatever dogma they were believing in, maybe, for example, they were Catholics before, or maybe they were, you know, born-again Christians, or maybe they were Mormons before, maybe they were just working-class people who, you know, just sat at home watching soap operas when they came home from work. They've woken up from that, but then they've been sold a bunch of lies by, you know, various people, you know, that are basically telling them that the whole of reality is created by them, like you just said, and nothing is real, apart from, of course, what they're being told by that person. Oh, that's real.
Yeah. And that person also exists, even though nothing else exists. So what kind of insanity is that?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I host space camps in the south of France every year where I train people in astronomy. And I have people coming from all over the world, and they often turn up with books that they're reading. And a lot of those books are copies. The text is a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And I also host filmmaking masterclasses as well. Again, people come from New Zealand, they come from Australia, and again, they turn up with these books, and they're the text is a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And they come here, and I've got a library of about 5,600 books, and I collect original or near original ancient texts. I've got, you know, books that go back to the pre-medieval era. And then, you know, we sit down and they're here for a week and, you know, I'm training them in astronomy or I'm training them in filmmaking. And I show them original texts and things. And it kind of, you know, shows them the root of where a lot of these ideas are stolen and plagiarized from. And it's amazing that they kind of go through a second awakening after they've been here. And I'm glad to have been able to help those people, because a lot of them would have ended up being more or less kind of sheep again. And instead of believing the dogma that they believed before, they're believing a different kind of dogma. They believe that, say, for example, the moon is made of titanium, and it was manufactured by aliens, and it's an artificial satellite or something like that. And then they come here, and then we study the moon, and we see the moon, and then they learn about the moon, and they actually see great detail in the moon for the first time using these giant telescopes. And, you know, it's a new awakening for them, because they realize, oh, really? Ah, yeah, that does exist, and it's not, you know, it's not a perception distortion. It's real and it's been there for a long time. Thank God we have got it as well, because the moon has the surface that it's got because it's got hundreds of thousands of craters simply because it acts like a Hoover, and it attracts comets and it attracts asteroids, and the asteroids hit the moon, thankfully, rather than coming to us. I mean, the asteroid that went through the sky of Russia just a few months ago, it actually exploded with the same kind of detonation power as the atomic bomb that hit Hiroshima in Japan in 1945. So, you know, and you can see the meteor crater in Flagstaff in Arizona. I mean, you just you don't want those things coming here, basically, and it's really good that we've got a moon like we have.
Indeed. And what I found that you said was quite interesting there is about how people believing fallacies, they wind up becoming followers again, right, rather than leading yourself, which is as you should do, you know, taking personal responsibility for your actions and so forth. It's akin to somebody who's a priest at the Church of Satan believing a whole lot of nonsense and doing evil stuff or whatever, you know, theoretically speaking, and then becoming a born-again Christian and then preaching to everybody that you're going to go to hell because the Catholic Church says so.
Yes, in actual fact, there are a lot of those types of people around who've been members of covens. Usually they get kind of hoodwinked into becoming a member. Some of them are actively seeking those kinds of brotherhoods. And I've met quite a lot of those people. I've interviewed people that were indoctrinated into Masonic brotherhoods, and then they realize, hang on a minute, you know, they think, hang on a minute, what did he say? And then they sort of, you know, they hear something, and it triggers them to go off and do their own research. There's a great book called Freemasonry, Is It a Religion? And it's written by a former clergyman, a former priest, and it's a great little book. And I read that years and years and years ago. And the guy actually dissects what he was taught. And, you know, he comes to the conclusion that Freemasonry is not, you know, a society of butterfly collectors and innocent people. There's actually a thread that goes through that, that is actually, if you like, priming each Masonic temple through the hymns and the psalms which they sing and through the initiation ceremonies. Once all of those knife and fork kind of social Freemasons leave that temple, then there's new groups that come in, and they are much more serious, high-ranking magician-type Freemasons. And those groups are, you know, things like the Golden Dawn, which is still running to this day. You know, they've had many famous members. Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, Aleister Crowley, who was a part-time spy for Her Majesty's intelligence services, is Israel Regardi, who was an occult author who died just recently. You know, those high-ranking magical brotherhoods use the Masonic temples, usually in the middle of the night, after what I call the knife and fork social Freemasons have gone home. Now, that's what's going on.
Indeed, and I've interviewed one of the biggest Freemason whistleblowers since the late 1800s, James Wright. And he was 32nd degree. He was a paid kind of secretary for the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite in Dallas, Texas. And he was getting sexually propositioned by these married high-ranking Freemasons daily just because they knew he was gay. He was a witness and can account for numbers of really, really freaky rituals. And he's written two books on it. And then it turns out the publishers of his first book don't want a second book coming out because it's called The Filthy Rituals of Freemasonry Exposed. And it turns out that they belong to the Golden Dawn, who he also exposes in the book. And he didn't know this at the time. He was staying in, they gave him a car, you know, to get out of Dallas because he was under threat by the Masons there. And an apartment to live in with a security gate and all of that kind of stuff. And he couldn't quite figure out how on earth people were getting through a security gate all the time and leaving little symbols and sigils and things of that nature on the hood of his car that was parked inside the security gate, until he realized that these people were all working together. They only gave me somewhere to escape to so that they could monitor me.
Yes, well, they're not called brotherhoods for no reason. In the York Rite, which is, you know, a different flavor of Freemasonry to, you know, when you compare it to the Scottish Rite, I think it's the 11th or 13th degree. Each of these degrees is like an examination and initiation. In the York Rite, you swear to always stand behind a fellow brother, even if you know he is guilty of wrongdoing. Now, a lot of policemen are York Rite Freemasons, so where does that leave you? And then as they go up the initiatory scale of examinations and initiations, they get permission to kill their wife if they don't like her. So, it's not a good thing.
And of course, most Masons never even get above a couple of degrees anyway. They never hear about any of this kind of stuff, do they?
That's right. There is a big changeover between the fourth degree and the degrees above there. Most Masons become Master Masons. That's the third degree. And because it's got this grand title, Master Mason, they don't really bother to go any further. As you go up the levels of initiation, once you're beyond the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite tradition, there's a lot of Hebrew that you have to learn. It's like learning an individual separate language. There's hand gestures, there's postures, you know, there's different tools. You know, they're all symbolic tools, symbolic daggers, symbolic swords, symbolic hammers, set squares, kind of checkerboards or chessboards, all kinds of paraphernalia, different places you have to stand in the temple layout. And to be honest, a lot of those guys, they joined because their boss was a member. Or, you know, the local mayor who they wanted to be friendly with is a member. That's basically what drives the income. And Freemasonry is a business. And the Ordo Templi Orientis is a business. And the Golden Dawn is a business. These are all businesses based on money and membership and getting weekly dues, which are the weekly payments.
Well, how much would they be expected to pay? Do they pay more as they go up the scale? Or?
Yes, they do. It depends on the geographical location and the social standing of the members. I mean, if you have a little provincial lodge in the middle of nowhere, say in a little tiny village, they'll only pay about £3 a month. But some of the higher ranking lodges, they would expect £30 a month. So, you know, that's 10 times the amount.
But still not an extraordinary amount.
No, but if you consider that there's millions and millions and millions of these Masons, that money soon adds up every week.
Oh, so you're talking about £3 a week or £30 a week, not per month?
Well, yeah, I think the average in England is about 20-something pounds a month. And we have, I think, somewhere in the region of between 3.5 and 5 million Freemasons in the United Kingdom.
Just think, you could either be a Freemason or you could have digital television by satellite.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they, the United Grand Lodge has got probably somewhere in the region of about, this is a pretty accurate guesstimate, I would say, it's probably got somewhere in the region of between 11 and 25 million pounds a month coming in.
Sweet Mother of Mercy. What on earth do they do with all this money?
Well, they have their big buildings. they, you know, they obviously maintain their own lifestyles. They have libraries and they have a good life. The people at the top of Freemasonry, you know, they're pretty okay financially.
And is there any skullduggery involving the business kind of thing? Because I've always found that with with groups that are able to keep secrets within themselves, they often wind up doing business with a whole bunch of other different groups in many different sectors of society without that being found out either.
Well, when I made my first Illuminati documentary, it's just called The Illuminati. I made that in 2004. I investigated the biggest gold bullion robbery in history, which is called the Brinks-Matt Bullion Raid. And I discovered that the guy organizing the gang was a Freemason. And then I discovered which lodge he was a member of. And then I discovered that the guy who was in charge at the Serious Fraud Office of investigating the Brinks-Matt Bullion Gang was a Freemason as well. And he was a member of the exact same lodge. And then I found out that they were friends. so, you know, unfortunately, that's the kind of things that go on.
Well, I guess it's, I was just thinking about, funnily you should mention this in criminality. I was just thinking about, have you ever been friends with criminals, right? Like people who actually kind of commit crimes for a living or met these kind of people, and you know, whether would they be, I don't know, they've robbed houses before or they're a drug dealer or something of that nature. I find that they're always really guarded and often they have somebody to back them up, right? They don't like going things alone. And
I don't really mix in those types of circles, but crime and criminality, it comes in all shapes and sizes, and it's pretty obvious from the revelations of Mr. Snowden that the royal corporate political elite, they consider everyone as being either a terrorist or a potential terrorist, because in his latest revelations, he says that the National Security Agency is actually tracking 5.1 billion smartphones. Well, that's probably every phone that's out there, because about 2 billion people live in abject poverty on this planet. And there's 7.3 billion people on the planet. And there's 5.1 billion phones every 24 hours being tracked.
And I can guarantee you, some of them people have got multiple phones on them, don't they?
Some people do, yeah.
Yeah.
That's very true.
I can never fathom that. Why would you need, like, 8 phones?
I know, it's strange, isn't it? I mean, I know my nephews. You know, my nephew, he pulled an iPhone out of his pocket, and I thought, wow, I was very impressed. He's only 14. And, and I said, wow, you know, I haven't even got an iPhone. That's amazing that you've got one of those. And then he pulled a BlackBerry out of his other pocket and said, I've got one of those as well. It's just amazing.
What do you call a cell phone you can stab people with?
No idea.
A knife phone.
Very good.
You know, I've got this idea. Like, I've interviewed a number of people about smart meters and EMF, electricity, radiation, pollution, that kind of thing recently.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like now we're currently bathing in this unbelievable atmosphere of just crap, assault in our bodies and our immune systems and everything at all times. I feel like I'm stressed, like I'm under attack constantly.
Well, yeah, well, that's very true. That's been going on for a long time. I've actually made a film called Spirit World, and I made that in 2007. And I discuss this cocoon of spiritual energy, which was accepted as being a real aspect of nature by all of the great philosophers and all of the great scientists in the ancient world. And it's called the ether. And Tesla believed in it. And everyone believed in the ether until Einstein came along. And he kind of changed people's perceptions of the ether. But the ether was written into textbooks. When you, studied physics, you had to study the ether. And the ether is this cocoon of energy. It covers the entire planet. It's like the layers of an onion. And now, of course, we call it the Higgs field, because Einstein kind of came in and he changed the rules a little bit in physics, and he came up with special relativity and several other thought experiments, which people, kind of more or less they've confirmed everything that he was putting down into his writings. And Einstein and Niels Bohr and Oppenheimer and many of these leading figures in physics and nuclear physics, they come from Hebrew families. And of course, Hebrew families often have books of the Kabbalah and the Merkaba, and the Merkaba type texts like the Zohar, the Book of Light, in their family libraries. And if you look at modern physics, and especially if you look at quantum physics, and you look at the research into the Higgs field and the Higgs boson, you can see that what they're actually teaching is a kind of modern version of the Kabbalah, where in the Zohar you have 10 spheres, and each of these spheres is a kind of zone, if you like. And as you go from one sphere to the next, matter becomes denser and denser and heavier until you get to the final sphere, and that's our planet, and that's reality. And that is what really basically quantum physics is. It's a kind of modern reinterpretation of the Kabbalistic worldview of the astral world, the invisible realms, and the physical realms.
Is there any validity to that Kabbalistic interpretation of reality?
Well, that's what they're doing. They're going through a process of validating the Kabbalah and redressing it and repackaging it as nuclear physics, quantum physics, and classical physics.
That's pretty messed up thinking there.
Well, you know, I don't know. You know, the spirit world obviously does exist. I mean, yeah. I don't recommend any of the listeners do this or any of the viewers do this, but, you know, I've just spent 3 years and I'm still in the process of making Spirit World 3, which is the third made-for-cinema documentary about paranormal research. And in my film, I've been given permission for the very first time to take my cameras inside all kinds of temples while rituals are going on. This is very rare. You never see this kind of thing. And in my film, you know, you can actually see a Hebrew Ouija board seance, and it's taking place in Jerusalem, and very silly. I know it's so stupid. What they did is that they decided to call the spirit of Lucifer and Satan to speak to them via the Ouija board.
Oh, that's a wise idea.
Yeah. And in my film, you can see that they get completely freaked out. People start, really just basically going into shock. And they take their hands and their fingers off of the glass, but the glass continues moving. Not only does it move off of the board, it moves onto the floor and it continues moving across the floor, and it's got so much spirit force in it, it actually knocks over a can of drink. And, you know, this film, Spirit World 3, it's taken me a long time to actually make it. Two main reasons is that, first of all, these types of groups don't like me coming in there with my camera. And it takes a long time to convince them, and I have to show them my original films and gradually gain their trust. And the second reason is that a lot of loonies and I suppose you could call them, you know, psychiatric casualty type people who've been on the fringe of these occult groups and who see me as an enemy because I'm exposing this and I'm actually doing broadcasts like this, Vinny, all the time. They see me as the enemy because, you know, none of these secret groups can really survive that long with somebody like me around where I expose all their secrets. And they've done everything they can to try and stop me from making this new Spirit World film. But I've continued to the point where I'm going into like the third stage of production now. And I've re-edited and added new material and I've remastered the film 3 times now. Because people keep coming forward to me and giving me new information. And I've actually got footage for the very first time of actual rituals going on. So I'm pleased with the film. It's got some distance to go yet in its production.
May I ask, what compels you to put so much into this field of research and everything that it is that you do? Because I thought about this myself, what compels me to do what I do the other day.
Yeah.
And it's about, ultimately, I admitted to myself, it's about justifying my existence. You know, I have to do something good with my life.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would agree with that, absolutely. I mean, I enjoy learning about things. I certainly enjoy traveling. I go to, you know, every single corner of the planet, and I very much enjoy that. I'm a people person. I enjoy meeting people. I do it full time. There's nothing else that I do. And at heart, I'm really basically an investigative journalist and author. I make films because the visual documentaries, when they go out into the independent cinemas, and they usually play in late shows, my types of films, I like it because a film is able to deliver a huge amount of information in that 2-hour period in the dark to a large group of people who are sitting in the cinema. Whereas when I write my books, that's a different kind of way of disseminating the information, because when you read a book, it's a personal relationship between the reader and the author. So, you know, I enjoy doing it, basically. But I want to improve the situation. I want to flush out of the system not only the corrupt politicians, but also all of these kind of weird savior, guru, messiah type people that I've interviewed in the past, which I feel are just really taking things way too far now. And they need to be reined in by common sense and logic, because they, like I said earlier in the broadcast, they don't have any knowledge of ancient languages or even modern foreign languages, and it's all copied out of other books, and it's like Chinese whispers, and a lot of people are being misled. And I think one of the other incentives is that I do see people trying to make a difference, and they're making films the same as I make films, but they haven't quite got it. They haven't quite worked out that there is really basically only, I'd say, three factions running the entire geopolitical situation on the planet. And they make their films, and there's some really good films that have been stuck out on these video sharing websites. But they're like watching a bunch of political scientist kind of students. And they've got good ideas. I mean, the Zeitgeist movement's got good ideas, really good. I mean, the resource-based economy idea based on sharing the resources of the planet is an excellent idea. And it's something which I'd like to see happen. And I think Peter Joseph, his heart is definitely in the right place. There's no question about it. Unfortunately, of course, is that the royal elite who've been in charge for centuries upon centuries, who monopolize uranium, monopolize diamonds, gold, sapphires, emeralds, oil, gas. They're not interested in sharing. They're not interested in sharing any of those resources, which is kind of overlooked in Peter's films, unfortunately. But that's not his fault. But that's just the way it is, you know.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because I just watched Success or Oblivion. I think that's the name of it. A documentary done about Jacques Fresco and the Venus Project and these models and different cities and all of these kind of things. And I'm inclined to agree with you that absolutely this looks like a brilliant idea for a future. You know, it's got a few hobnobs here and there that I don't like the look of, but look at the whole picture versus what we've got currently as a whole picture. And there's certainly a heck of a lot of a better alternative. And Fresco even says in it, this is not perfection. I don't think we'll ever even achieve it. This is just a hell of a lot better than whatever we've got going on now.
Yes.
But again, and I want to back up your point, when you're looking at a cancerous body, there's two things you've got to do. You've got to inject some health into that body, and you've got to get rid of the cancer, right?
Yes.
What these
yes.
people are talking about doing is putting health into the body without getting rid of the cancer. It will just continue to grow and metastasize.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, Mr. Fresco, I've seen his designs. I studied architecture as well at Celtec in London, which is like one of the leading construction architectural. I mean, they teach everything. They teach even basic things like bricklaying. And, you know, I was going to be a doctor, and To be honest, you know, I saw the holes through the medical mafia system very early on, and I'm very glad that I didn't actually follow through with it. So in the end, I signed up to this architectural course, architecture and construction. I'm glad I did. Mr. Fresco does have designs which resemble the kind of boys' own almanacs that I used to read when I was like 7 or 8 years old, Cities of the Future. And it's a very good idea to have modern facilities and to, you know, have a modern, egalitarian, equal, beautiful and clean environment. Unfortunately, he's gone down the route of those types of 19, you know, the view of what, you know, the Venus Project reminds me of books published in the 1950s that had drawings of what life would be like in 1975, where we would all have our own private flying saucers and we'd wear these biodegradable kind of all-in-one spacesuits, and we'd have, you know, microwaves, and we'd eat, like, you know, perfectly nutritious pills. That idea and those ideas that became very popular were basically, you know, doable. They are doable. And we could have had, you know, a much better infrastructure in most of our cities by now. Of course, the Illuminati, and when I say the Illuminati, I'm talking about all the different factions of the Illuminati. I'm talking about the royal, the political, and the corporate factions. they seem to be having a great time forcing mankind to be competitive. And this competitive aspect to human society and the fiscal world, the financial world, has kind of stolen the future away, you know. I mean, the modern trains which we have now in, say, for example, the United Kingdom, you know, they're very nice inside and everything. You know, they're decorated nicely. But those modern trains are running on railway tracks that were paid for from the taxes of our great-grandparents. You know, I mean, you know, we really do need to rip up and throw away the old style designs that are holding back the future. And what's holding it back is investment and finance and competition and profits, which is very unfortunate. But, you know, I think that the European and the Russian and the American factions will come a cropper eventually, because the Oriental world in terms of technology is racing ahead. I mean, they have floating magnetic levitating trains in the Oriental world already.
Now, I also, something interesting here, we're talking about finance and capital. There was an article released, I forget who, but it was something along the lines of a number of extraordinarily wealthy billionaires, like over 100 of them, that gave the vast majority of their fortunes away to charities. The problem is, all of these charities that they gave them to, none of them do any infrastructure projects.
Oh, I see. That's a great pity. I think most of the foundations, especially the foundations set up by former presidents, like political presidents, like the Clinton Foundation, things like that.
Ford Foundation.
They are basically receptacles of money that would otherwise end up in the actual tax system, because many countries have a situation where if you give a pound to a charitable non-profit organization, that's a pound less from your tax bill. So rather than having a $40 million tax bill at the end of the year, they set up a foundation and give $40 million to the foundation.
Now, it's interesting as well, because the perspective's kind of skewed here when people talk about taxes. in New Zealand just yesterday, the New Zealand Herald put out benefit fraud was $39 million last year, whereas tax dodging was $1 billion last year. Okay.
Yes.
And they treat the tax dodging as like, oh, it's nothing, you know, and they treat the $39 million benefit fraud as, oh my God, how terrible.
Yes, of course, because it's war on the working classes. That's why.
Yeah, and my perspective is all the taxes are illegal anyway. So what the government's doing is just crying out about how people are stealing the money they stole from them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. Tax is not about running the services of the state. It's about a weapon which is used against the working classes. Once you've got £1 million, you've got enough spare money to pay a small army of very clever accountants, and you'll never pay a penny in tax. I mean, very, very large corporations that are turning over billions aren't paying very much tax at all. Google was just investigated by the Parliamentary Accounts Committee of Her Majesty's Parliament because they're running this thing called a Dutch sandwich, which is shifting literally.
It sounds like some kind of sexual favor.
It does sound a bit suggestive, but they're moving billions of pounds around the planet to avoid giving Her Majesty her cut. I mean, you know,
so she can heat Buckingham Palace.
The what, sorry?
So she can heat Buckingham Palace. There was an article that came out of the Daily Mail saying that the Queen said, "I want to take $10 million out of the UK's poverty fund so that I can heat my palaces that I don't live in."
Yeah, well, that says it all, doesn't it? You know, I mean, look, we don't need to pay a single penny in tax to run a beautiful system. If we had governments that had invested properly the tax paid by our great, great, great grandparents and all the generations before us, then they would have built up a massive nest egg, and that nest egg would generate interest, which would pay for everyone on the planet to have a wonderful life. But they haven't done it. I mean, the government shutdown that we've just experienced in the USA, what a joke. I mean, you know, I'm an astronomer. I went to the NASA website and there was a sign on there saying, you know, this site isn't available because of the government shutdown. What a joke. I mean, you know, they're giving you the impression that the administration is running hand to mouth. As soon as Congress stops giving them the money, they shut down the whole of the government. This is proof that every single penny and every single cent that's ever been stolen from the wage packets of our ancestors has been squandered. You know, I mean, what's going on here? So that's my view about taxation. You know, it's just, it's a weapon, and it's as simple as that. And it's only the working classes that pay it.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, I think that wraps it up for a good first hour of this interview, Chris. And one thing we did forget is to plug your website.
Yes, well, I have many. My personal website is christopherevarard.com. You can watch the Enigma channel. You can sign up for a free account. It's enigmatv.com, enigmatv.com. It doesn't exist on YouTube or anywhere else, though. People who purport to be me are usually weirdos and cult members or even intelligence agencies, because I make documentaries that tell people what the intelligence agencies are really doing. So that's enigmatv.com. And you have to be very careful if you look for me on Facebook. There's at least 7 or 8 fake versions of me at any one time. And you can also check out my book. I write books. My latest book is called Stone Age Psychedelia, and you can go to stoneagepsychedelia.com.
Excellent. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated and Fukushima irradiated island chained paradise of New Zealand, where everybody has a part time job as an eco light bulb to keep it clean and green. And my very special guest is Chris Everard from ChristopherEverard.com and EnigmaTV.com, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. That is right.
Now, it occurred to me, I don't do research on my guests. This is part of the format of my show. So when somebody like you comes along and I see multiple talents, high level of skill, proficiency, articulate, creative, honourable, decent, that, all of those.
That's
all
very of those, nice of you to say that.
Well-travelled, knowledgeable, wise. There's a lot of things in there. And I think men like yourself don't give yourself enough credit. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sorry, could you say that again?
You don't give yourself enough credit.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say that. Well, you know, we try and do what we do.
I know, and I think that's the reason why it doesn't kind of take you over, because you interview a lot of people who have similar talents and skill sets. And what I said to you, and this is a quote from Snoop Dogg here, what I just said to you, that's from the heart. Don't let it go to your head, brother.
That's good. I like that.
Because you see, a lot do, in fact, let it go to their head. And I've been checking myself recently, just going, getting all these compliments and starting to think, no. I've got to play this down a little bit.
Well, yeah, that's true. The media world is a very strange world. You know, I used to be a recording engineer, and, you know, I never used to earn very much money at all. I used to earn so little money that I didn't have the bus fare to go home. And so I used to sleep in the studio. And, you know, basically I did that for quite a few years until my first book came out. And then it was successful. And, you know, I come from a very, very poor background. So I do appreciate, you know, all of the support I get from everyone around the planet. And there you go, you know.
Well, it keeps you down to earth and rooted anyway, because I think it's as soon as you start thinking that I'm here because of me and only my actions have got me here, then you stop appreciating all the little helpers along the way, and then you become a real douchebag.
That's it. I've got a question for you, Vinny. The Maori people are very fascinating people, and I've done quite a lot of research into the Maori, and I've done a lot of research into the Aborigines as well.
Yes.
Is there any evidence of Aboriginal people from Australia actually travelling and setting up, you know, communities in New Zealand in the ancient times?
Not that I've seen. There is evidence of pre-Maori civilizations that go back thousands of years, passed down by oral tradition. There are stories of what became in modern times to be thought of as wood nymphs or something like that from ancient legend.
I see.
Were actually real people who were just kind of like pale with red hair and that kind of thing.
That's very interesting.
Constructed ancient walls, towns. Like, they had these dome houses that were made entirely out of little individual stones that were all stacked together. Such was the craftsmanship that those domes are still here today, 1,000+ years after those people who built it are gone.
Wow, that's fascinating. I did not know that. It strikes me that the facial features of the Maori people, you know, when you study Polynesian ritual, you'll see that the ritual, they're called power figures. They're usually about 2 or 3 feet high. You know, they're carved out of palm wood, or other different types of wood. Sometimes
would this be the little god Bess?
Yes, things like that. They can look like totem poles. They can look, all, you know, they take all kinds of shapes and sizes. Yeah, sometimes they're carved out of coconut.
Yeah, we've got all those things down here as well.
Yeah.
And it looks as though a lot of the tattooing has great similarities with Egyptian pharaoh headdresses with the lines coming down and what have you. And you see those patterns repeated in Maori ritualistic tattooing of the face to connote somebody of honor, royalty, chiefship, etc., with those same symbols and motifs.
Wow, that's fascinating. I did realize, and I've been researching this just recently, that there are close parallels between what the Egyptians were doing with their embalming fluids and the oils in ancient Australia, because the eucalyptus oil is obviously taken from the eucalyptus tree, which is an Australian tree, and the mummies were being embalmed using eucalyptus oil in ancient Egypt. So they must have had some kind of trading routes where, you know, presumably the Aboriginal people were collecting the eucalyptus oil, they were selling it on, then somebody else sold it on, or the Egyptians actually managed to make their way to Australia.
Mm. I think maybe the ancient world actually had a lot more technological advances than we do today.
And it
And everything was quite modern. You know, we see traveling that distance and having those trade routes is like impossible for them back then. And then maybe back then they had even better stuff than we did, mate. Maybe they could teleport there, and who frickin' knows? There's certainly many ancient technologies that have been unearthed that are more advanced than we have.
Yeah, I mean, I've traveled the whole world. I've actually written two electronic digital books with, photographs from all these trips that I've made that analyzes exactly what the technology was in the ancient world. And at the National Museum of Cairo, there's a giant sarcophagus there, which is kind of tucked away, and they keep it on its side. And it's not really part of the main exhibits in the National Museum. And when I do my expeditions there, I take groups there and I show them this giant, it's an enormous sarcophagus. It must be about 11 or 12 feet long. And it's got a giant, perfect cut in it, which has been abandoned halfway through. I don't know why. But it's obviously been made by some machine. There's no way that, two humans or even a team of humans could have done this cut.
Maybe it was only halfway because whatever they were cutting with broke halfway because it was too tough.
It might have done. I wouldn't be surprised if it did. But in my e-books, I've done two e-books about ancient technology. And in Greece, they had kinds of steam-powered robotic kind of devices off the coast of in Antikythera in the Greek shipping lanes, divers they dredged up this amazing mechanism, and it's at least 2,000 years old. You can see it at the Athens National Museum, and it is actually a clockwork device that tracks planets, tracks the solar cycles, and is obviously some kind of computer calculator to aid people who were involved in astrology. And astrology and astronomy were not separate disciplines in those times. Astrology is essentially the study of the spirits, the actual creative, intelligent forces of the various planets and how they manifest themselves in an invisible, almost telepathic way on each other and also on all living creatures in, you know, their local vicinity. And that was all amalgamated with mathematics, you know, astronomical observation and astronomy in general. And the Mayans, of course, just amazing culture. They built an observation tower, which is still standing to this day in the Mexican hinterlands. And it's very obvious that the Greek society, like you were saying, was not a primitive society by any standards whatsoever. They had great philosophers. They had these steam-powered kind of robotic machines. And the Library of Alexandria was not just a library of scrolls and texts. It actually had moving robotic steam-powered statues and other technologies. And the Antikythera mechanism is an amazing artifact because it stands alone in history. I mean, there isn't anything that is clockwork. You know, there's a gap of, I think, something like 1,700 years between the Antikythera clockwork mechanism and when clocks, you know, started to be engineered and created in Europe for navigational purposes. So it's mind-blowing.
Yeah. I think Jonathan Gray, archaeologist from New Zealand, has written a book called Dead Men's Secrets about 20 different technologies the ancient world possessed that are far in advance of what we've got today. And my theory is that there was once a global society, really technologically advanced global society, you know, all working together. They had global electricity through pyramids and stuff all over the world. And
yes.
And at one point, some freaking cataclysm happened and wiped everything out. Everything. It was all gone.
Hmm. Yes. I mean, I think they were dealing with very, very large voltages. You can see from the description of the Ark of the Covenant that the Levite priests that were allowed inside the tabernacle, which was like a kind of tented enclosure, that the Ark stayed inside that enclosure, they could not approach the Ark of the Covenant unless they had a band of, I think, copper around one ankle that was tethered to the ground. Well, that's obviously an earthing wire. And what I believe was inside the Ark of the Covenant is a series of what you call Leyden jars, which you can make at home. And these Leyden jars are kinds of capacitors. Now, the charge came from, I believe, obelisks, the obelisks that you see in Egypt, because the Ark of the Covenant is not a Jewish or Hebrew technology. It's actually an Egyptian technology. The Ark of the Covenant was made in Egypt. And I've studied these obelisks very carefully. And the last time I was in Egypt, I had a super definition camera. That's four times HD. And I filmed an obelisk that was on its side in Luxor, which is an amazing, it's a huge area. It's 213 square acres of temples. And there's this broken rose granite obelisk. It's on its side. And I filmed the absolute tip using a super definition camera. Now, you can see in the footage that the absolute tip is kind of charred, like charcoal. And we know that the absolute capstones, the pyramid-shaped pinnacle of these obelisks in the ancient world, had sheaths of electrum. They weren't just raw granite. They actually had this sheath over them. And electrum is made from very, very, very thin layers of gold and silver. And, of course, this is what goes on in electronics design today. You know, you have different materials layered together that set up different resistances. And, you know, this type of technology is still around to this day. And down the side of those obelisks, I believe that what they had is on one corner of the obelisk, they had some conduit metal, and at the base there was an Ark of the Covenant. And there is a phenomenon called St. Elmo's Fire, which you can often see on the tips of masts of ships if you get stormy weather. And whenever there was a turbulent time in the atmosphere there, these obelisks would collect the electrostatic geomagnetic energy from the atmosphere, pass that down a wire into the Ark of the Covenant. And then the Ark of the Covenant had two, if you like, an anode and a cathode on the top, or two jump terminals. And the elite, you know, the Levite priesthood probably discharged sparks and things to show people, look how clever we are. You know, look, we can create a spark. That spark comes from God. And, you know, I think that's really basically what was going on.
So it was basically like a big magician's trick.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a great film that Mel Gibson made called Apocalypto. And you can see that the ruling elite, you know, because his film is like a kind of synthesis of the Aztec culture and the Mayan culture. And in Guatemala and the Yucatan Peninsula, you know, they made a very, very big point of actually mapping and being able to predict to the minute when eclipses would happen. And in the Apocalypto film, you know, the elite, they obviously know that an eclipse is going to happen that day. And they stage this grand public event, and they sacrifice people at that point. And, you know, they make it look as if the king has created the eclipse. And, of course, you know, it's only in recent times that the peasantry, the working classes, have been able to read. I mean, there were actually countries in Europe right up until 1910, 1920, where the illiteracy rates were incredibly high. I mean, countries like Macedonia, Albania, parts of Poland, I mean, they, you know, they had huge numbers of people that did not read. And, of course, you know, we've now got the internet. So people's acceleration of knowledge has just gone exponential in just the last, since about 95. Yeah, certain people, yeah.
Because the reverse is true for a large amount of people who still don't read.
That's very true. That is very true, yeah. I mean, if they do read, they read, you know, tabloid newspapers, and that gives them, of course, tabloid attitudes to life.
Oh, I read. I once read a whole magazine cover to cover.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to be freaking kidding me.
Yeah, well, thank our lucky stars that the mainstream publishing world, like, the established newspapers and the established magazines, are actually dead. Even though they will not let on, there's basically about 85% of all those magazines that you see on the magazine shelves are pulped at the end of the month. And this is the influence of the internet. Of course, that is not really being discussed, because many of the big mainstream media moguls like Silvio Berlusconi is up in court in Italy at the moment on paedophile charges with his Bunga Bunga parties. He not only owns television channels, but he owns radio stations, and of course he owns publishing companies. And those people control the mainstream channels, and the mainstream channel is not going to admit that their newspaper business is on its knees, but they are.
They're not going to admit Berlusconi was showing his austerity package to children.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't really children. It was, these girls from Morocco who, you know, befriend powerful and rich people in Italian political circles. And, you know, they host certain parties where they dress up as police officers and all this kind of thing. They're called Bunga Bunga parties. And Berlusconi is, if you like, he's like an Italian version of Rupert Murdoch. He owns about a third of all the radio, television, and newspapers in France. He's got a lot of investments in radio stations throughout Europe. And he was obviously the leader of Italy. He was a member of the P2E, the P2 Masonic Lodge, with various other industrialists and leading businessmen in Italy. And he actually has formed his own Masonic Lodge. And there's been actually mafia bosses who've gone on trial in Italy. And they've actually admitted in court, in front of the judges, that not only do they know personally Mr. Berlusconi, but one of them actually said that, you know, many years ago, before Mr. Berlusconi had, you know, become the leader of the Italian nation, that Berlusconi actually said to one of the mafia bosses, you know, I'll put my company in your hands, you know, whatever I can do for the mafia, just tell me. So he's going through a very bad time at the moment, just to put it mildly, you know.
Yeah. I do think that this kind of thing is not isolated, though. You call him the Rupert Murdoch of Italy. There's all sorts of sizes and shapes and colours. Basically, I found out what happens is I think the British Empire figured out that if you use foreign troops on your soil, people see foreigners and they get really angry. But if you just bribe people from the inside to just, you know, suck it up and BS everybody on your behalf, nobody cares.
Yeah, well, bribery is one of the mainstays of modern international capitalism. But it's a subject which very many people never discuss.
Money talks? Where do you think that phrase comes from, mate?
that's very true, yeah. Yeah, it is true.
Yeah, but unfortunately, there's some people for whom money isn't really the reason why they do what they do kind of thing. It's power.
Yes, that's right. The money, you know, having financial resources brings you options, and that's really what they're after.
I want the option of being able to, I don't know, have you ever seen or heard of the movie Hostel?
Yes, it's one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
Eli Roth, I've met Eli Roth.
Yeah, I thought it'd be one of your favorite films for some reason. And what it contains, for those of you in the audience who have not heard of or seen this film, which is quite brilliant, by the way.
It is a very good film, yeah.
You got evil, scumbaggery rich people who pay so that they can torture and kill innocent people who get kidnapped.
Well, yeah, they don't. It's a bit more complicated than that, because it's not like they're just going up to somebody and shooting them and just killing them. They're actually having a sadistic entertainment, if you like, through the slow torture of innocent people who are usually backpackers. And it happens in Eastern Europe, and it's all to do with money. And they bid against each other. The rich people bid against each other to have the morbid and sick pleasure of slowly torturing a backpacker. Well, it is an amazing storyline, because, you know, there are such things as snuff films, and this is an unfortunate phenomenon that's been around since the very early days of when camcorders became cheap enough for people to buy. And these snuff films, you know, they are real, and it's not make-believe, and the people that you see being tortured are real people, and it's real torture, and the people that you see dying in these films are really, really being killed. And this, unfortunately, is an aspect of what goes on in these elite circles. I mean, it's almost like they have so many billions of dollars. Some of them have even got trillions. Money becomes meaningless. And so, you know, what's left? I mean, they want to explore their morbid fascinations. Now, if we turn the clock back, what we see in a modern film like Hostel, we can see that actually being done in the ancient world, like Countess Elizabeth Bathory. You know, she was out in Transylvania, And she would actually bathe in the blood of young aristocratic ladies and, you know, any kind of young girl that she could get from any village in the local vicinity. And she would bathe in their blood. She would kill them and bathe in their blood. And then there was Prince Vlad. Now, this is not make-believe. This is real. And he used to impale hundreds, if not thousands, of people. He used to get mothers to eat their babies. And this Prince Vlad family is still around to this day. And many of these world leaders are actually related to the family of Prince Vlad. One of them is the former president of France, Sarkozy, who's a family that comes from Hungary. They're related to Prince Vlad. And also the Tsars of Russia were particularly vicious and vindictive people. You know, they would torture dogs and cats and things like that. And this is all documented. None of what I'm telling you is a conspiracy theory. This has all been confirmed by servants and witnesses. And in the more modern era, coming up to the beginning of the 20th century, we actually see real evidence of members of the royal families killing people with their own hands. And I've made a documentary about that called Murdered by the Monarchy. And every second of every minute of that 2-hour film, which I, you know, is a made for cinema documentary, is, you know, researched. I traveled, you know, probably more than about 2,000 miles making that film. And in the film, I explain to people that Grand Duke Dmitri of Russia, with his own hands, actually strangled a monk called Rasputin, poisoned him. They shot him. They threw him in a river. And this is going on even to this day. And when I say that, people go, no, no, the royal families wouldn't do that. Well, they do. They do. We've had several suspicious suicide, you know, they're kind of murders, but they're made to look like suicides just in the recent times. And then, of course, Princess Diana. I mean, just look at that situation.
Well, she said before she died that she thinks that the royals are going to kill her in a car accident.
Absolutely.
You know, there were 14 security cameras that that covered her route from the hotel through to the tunnel, and all 14 of those security cameras magically disappeared, and all the tapes didn't record anything that night. And the reporter, the alleged paparazzo who was supposedly there and caused the accident, was found burned to death in his car, the very first person in European history to have ever done that.
Yes, he burnt to death in his car, and the car was locked, but it was locked from the outside. I mean, there's so many inconsistencies. I made a documentary. It's a 4-hour film, and it's called Lady Di. Lady D-I-E. Lady Di. Mm. And I bought the exact same Mercedes limousine as what Diana was being driven in. And I drove it along the actual tunnel. And then I actually did the actual route from the tunnel to the hospital. And in rush hour Paris traffic, I did that in 9.25 minutes. The ambulance that took Diana to that hospital, which could have taken much less than 9.25 minutes because I did it in rush hour traffic, took at least 1.5 hours. That's the official story. Of course, there isn't a single bypasser, there isn't a single member of the public that saw the ambulance traveling along like a snail. The whole thing is murder, black and white murder. And in actual fact, Princess Diana survived the crash. She did not die in that Mercedes. This is a very misunderstood aspect to the entire crash. She was fit. She was going to the gym. She was almost super fit. And, you know, she did not die in that Mercedes. What happened is that she was loaded into the back of this ambulance that mysteriously took an hour and a half to do a 9-minute journey. And it was in the back of the ambulance, which pulled over onto the side of the road, literally a stone's throw from the door of the hospital. And that is actually where Diana was murdered. Mm. And she was murdered by agents, and they were, I believe, private contractors. And they were dressed as ambulance staff. And by the time that she arrived at the hospital, so much damage had been done to her that it was impossible to actually save her.
They kind of tortured her the whole way, didn't they?
I think so. I think so. I mean, you know, it's really disgusting. And, you know, just look at today's situation that we have now.
Hey, you know what? Here's a wild theory for you. What if the agents were paid not only to kill her, not only to torture her, but to film it and get the video back to the royals so they could watch it?
Well, weirder things have happened. I've never come across that. I've got no evidence for that.
Neither do I. But I was just thinking it'd be exactly the same kind of thinking that would that they'd think of, you know.
Well, I mean, snuff movies, like I said earlier, they do exist.
Imagine the Princess Diana snuff film. Wow.
Well, look at the situation we have now, Vinny. I mean, if you type in Princess Diana into any search engine, within the top 3 or 4 search results, you're going to see, you know, like the letters that she wrote. And she wrote 2 of those letters. And the words are, they're planning a car accident, serious head injuries, and it's Charles, her husband, Prince Charles, who's planning the accident. And she wrote 2 of those letters. One was given to her butler and one was given to Lord Michon, who's her appointed lawyer. And that comes up in every single search engine, and it's usually in the top 5 results.
You know, these royals really need to be frickin' arrested and put in jail for the rest of their life. I mean, would execution be too much of a stretch?
Well, I think the death penalty does exist in many Commonwealth countries still. But imagine if you're Prince Harry and you type in your mother's name into a search engine. I mean, I don't understand how this is being managed as a situation within the royal family.
Well, maybe it's because
have they got their own version of Google for Buckingham Palace or something? I just don't understand how. I mean, if you typed your mother's name into Google and it came up as like number 2 search result, a note from her saying that your father was planning a car accident to kill her, and that's exactly how she did actually die. What would you think?
Well, that would depend. It would depend whether or not I'm a psychopath too.
Well, one would hope that this cycle is now coming to an end. I believe that, you know, there have been other royal by decree murders. I mean, we had a murder of an MI6 officer in his apartment, literally just a few hundred yards from the headquarters of MI6 in Vauxhall in London, just recently. It's a classic bag and drag spy murder. I would hope, though, that this situation with Princess Diana would be the last nail in the coffin for this type of behavior, which has typified their family throughout the last few centuries. They've been stabbing and slashing their way to power, and I would hope that that's over now.
Yeah, well, I think when you're dealing with the elite, it's much like preparing for a hurricane. You prepare for the worst and hope for the best, and unfortunately, the best never comes your way.
Yeah.
It's always worse than what you could ever imagine, and I think that's... I think that's one of the really soul-destroying and indeed stressful parts of looking into this kind of information, is that it's almost like there was a video that was done about horror movies and a whole bunch of really scary accidents and things of that nature that actually happened during the production of these horror films.
Yeah.
strange things happen, bad things happen when you're looking into the darkness kind of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yes, they do. And if you even just discuss the spirit world, you know, the spirit world, like I said earlier in the broadcast, is real. I mean, the spirit force can be demonstrated very easily. I do not recommend anybody gets involved in trying to experiment it. There's plenty of evidence there to show that it is there. And you only have to discuss these things and the spirits start taking a big interest in you. And you have to be very careful because possession, spiritual possession, is a real phenomenon. And exorcism is not like you see in the movies. Sometimes it can take months or even years to clear a parasite, a spiritual parasite, from someone.
Well, indeed, during the filming of the movie The Exorcist, they actually had to call a real exorcist in to perform a real exorcism.
Well, yeah, I can tell you some other strange things with movies as well, yeah. Yeah, The Exorcist, I have to say, is... A lot of people have got the wrong idea of The Exorcist. It actually won 2 Academy Awards. It won 2 Oscars. And it's a very high-quality film. And there's a new remastered version of it called The Exorcist, The Version You've Never Seen. And there, what they've done, because obviously they never had the technology in the 1970s as what we have now, and finally, we can now actually see what the actual filmmakers originally wanted to do. But in those days, obviously, you know, 1973, everything was, you know, a lot more primitive in filmmaking technology than what we have now. And this new version is absolutely terrifying. But I have to say that Pazuzu, which is the statue... which is featured right at the very beginning with the priest, you know, who's in, I think, Iraq, some desert nation, and they dig up this statue. And the images of this statue that you see throughout the Exorcist movie, that is a real statue. You can see the original statue at the Louvre Museum in Paris. You can see a small version of it. These are ancient artifacts, ancient statues, at the British Museum in London, and it's called Pazuzu, and it's a real demon. And the research that William Blatty did is really high-quality research. William Peter Blatty is the writer of The Exorcist. And that Pazuzu figure... It's really interesting because you see it cropping up all over the place on MTV music videos. It's amazing.
Is that right? Well,
yeah.
And again, there's like one of the most interesting aspects of these fields of research is researching into mind control and just how powerful television programming, radio programming, and
all
these things can be.
Yeah.
I recall even a conversation I had with a friend of mine on the phone. He says, what are you doing? Oh, I'm going to sit down and watch a horror movie with my girlfriend. And he gets really, really angry with me and tells me not to watch it because it opens up dark channels and pathways and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's actual truth in what he was saying.
Yes, there is. I mean, obviously, there's different ways of watching movies. I mean, I often watch movies and I study film, you know, obviously, because I make films. And, you know, you can watch films on different levels, if you understand what I mean. You can watch a film from a technical, critical point of view. But if you allow your subconscious, and especially if you've been at work all day and you're a bit tired, you can actually invite the ether, you know, because... you know, in my film Spirit World, I explain that Sir Oliver Lodge, who is one of the pioneers of radio, and Sir William Crookes, who designed the Crookes tube, which is one of the kind of primary inventions that led John Logie Baird to invent television, all three of those guys, Sir Oliver Lodge, Sir William Crookes, and John Logie Baird, were all spiritualists. In actual fact, Sir William Crookes, who was president of the Royal Scientific Society in London, he married a psychic. And they were hosting seances. And what they really wanted to do, what John Logie Baird was really interested in doing, is designing a machine that allowed you to see images of beings and spirit forces in the ether. And through his research, he actually came about and stumbled on the way of transmitting an image electronically, and that became television.
Wow. Isn't that interesting? And then they also set the flicker rate so that you can't even process it in a beta wave state, which is your logical, analytical yeah. part of the brain, and you slip back into alpha, which is almost semi-awake, kind of. You know, so you're more suggestible?
Yes. Mind you, the frame rates have started to change now. I went to Japan and met a friend of mine. He works for one of the big broadcast companies there. And I saw a demonstration of 9K. Now, HD is 1920 pixels wide. Okay. This is 9,000 pixels wide. And it's a frame rate of 144 frames per second.
It'll zombify you in 2.3 seconds.
Well, in actual fact.
Hey, bro, come and watch that. Oh.
Well, I'll tell the listeners what it was like. They got this camera, this 9K camera, and they had this 9K TV. They filmed a scene through a window, and it was a lake with you know, some trees there in Japan. And you play that on that television, and the television doesn't look like a television. The picture looks like the TV becomes that window. It looks like you're looking out of a window.
Could you imagine porn on that thing?
Well, you imagine anything on there. I'm very interested in high definition technology like that because, you know, I do astrophotography. And now we have high definition. It's enabling me to basically get fantastic images of Saturn and Jupiter, and I'm actually kicking off a big project where I'm going to train up 500 people, and they're going to be equipped with pretty big telescopes, with HD cameras and HD video recorders on laptops, and we're going to have 500 people all around the planet feeding HD astrophotography feeds directly to the Enigma channel, and it'll be live, and you'll be able to if they see something strange or get a great image, they'll flag it up, and the viewers will be able to go to the Enigma channel every day and, you know, see almost in real time what, you know, say for example a telescope in, I don't know, Chile or Peru or something has seen. And it's a very, very big project. And it's, as I say, it's going to...
I was going to say, that sounds like a historical event in terms of project management.
Yeah, because, you know, this kind of thing has not been done before. We've got very, very big telescopes. There's all kinds of telescopes. We've got radio telescopes, optical telescopes, infrared telescopes. The thing is that these very, very big telescope facilities... Those big telescopes, they're very, very slow to move. You can't move those things very easily. It's all done with electric motors. So my secret space project is designed to train people up with telescopes. They're about 6 or 7 feet tall. They're on special geo mounts with bearings. And you can move them easily with your hand because the bearings make these six foot tall telescopes really. I mean, literally, you push it with one finger and it'll spin. It's rather like a record on a turntable. Mm. And, you know, having 500 people kitted up means that fast moving objects, anomalous objects. I mean, you've got comets, you've got asteroids, you've got ice balls, and, of course, UFOs. I mean, let's not forget about that. They travel very quickly, and you'll see that not a single one of these giant telescope installations has any decent images at all of these fast-moving celestial objects because they can't move the scope fast enough. But if you have a scope that you can manually manipulate, it's a bit like, training somebody to use it and to track an object. It's like trying, teaching somebody to play a guitar. There's a knack to it.
Or teaching somebody how to shoot a rifle straight.
Yeah. I mean, when you look through a telescope, up is down, down is up, left is right, right is left. And that's what I teach people. And I teach them, and I've captured very fast moving deep space objects. Don't ask me what the hell they are. I have no idea what they are. But they're the types of objects which zip past a big telescope like the Keck or one of these big installation telescopes. And of course, it's never even mentioned because, they're too slow to react. And so that's why there is still this giant hole in mankind's understanding of what potentially there could be out there in our own galaxy in terms of intelligent life.
So basically, they're looking at slow motion footage of a cheetah and we're seeing it in real time.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. I mean, Professor Frank Drake, he was funded by NASA to do a mathematical equation. It's actually called the Drake equation. It's a fascinating bloke. I mean, he really calculated how many stars there are in the Milky Way galaxy. There's a amazing number of stars in some galaxies. Milky Way galaxy is not really anything special. There's super galaxies out there that have got 100 billion stars like our sun. 100 billion in some galaxies. Then he calculated how far away is the perfect distance for a planet. So it's not so hot that it's like Mercury, which is very, very hot, not so far away that it's frozen like Pluto, just right, which is what the Earth is. Then he calculated, what the likelihood of how many of those stars with those planets would be around for about the same length of time, 4.5 billion years as the Earth. And then what the probability was that they had water, what the probability was that there was life forms that had gone through the similar evolutionary standards and processes that we're used to here on our planet. And the Drake equation came to a very interesting conclusion, and that is that there are 10,000 intelligent civilizations which are at least as advanced as mankind is today, just in the Milky Way galaxy. Mm-hmm. 10,000.
And there's a hell of a lot of galaxies, trillions, isn't it?
There are, well, in terms of the galaxies which we've mapped so far, we know that there are a minimum of 100 million galaxies. And like I say, some of those galaxies have 100 billion stars. Some galaxies don't have that number. But, because each galaxy is kind of, even the Messier objects, the Messier galaxies, they're all, most of them are spiral galaxies. But, each galaxy has its own, kind of number of stars and things. They all have their own kind of celestial fingerprint, if you know what I mean. But it's phenomenal. 10,000 civilizations which are developed at least the level of technology which we have.
I saw footage of a, I think, I don't know, I don't know what it was, but red dwarf star cluster. It's kind of like in a bit of a spiral. And what you see is this kind of bright star sort of coming out of the center of it and then rolling around the spiral and growing as it goes. And as it exits the end of the spiral of the red dwarf star cluster, it emerges as a fully formed galaxy. It was kind of like celestial reproduction. Some of these objects are able to reproduce or bring into existence other forms of celestial bodies. They're kind of like some kind of a galactic mother of sorts with a great big black hole for a birth canal.
Yeah, they're called nebulous nurseries, and what it is it's really basically condensation and precipitation of space dust. It's amazing. I mean, every molecule that we have inside us was at one time, you know, just distributed into space. We are the product of every single molecule that ever existed from the time of the birth of the universe. You know, it's really amazing.
Yeah, kind of like intelligent molecules, almost like smart dust or chemtrails.
Yeah. I mean, intelligence, I believe, you know, the etheric intelligence, I believe that the etheric intelligence probably is an eternal and never-ending and with no beginning phenomenon. I really do believe that the etheric non-physical intelligence is, if you like, the trigger for the organization of physical matter.
Yeah, it kind of has a consciousness. I theorize that what God is, right, is sort of like the latent energies of all living organisms to a certain degree of a God. Like, I'm God. But I'm only God to the 5 trillion cells in my body. They're like, wow, the God's moving everything. And then within one of those cells, there's a whole another civilization. And within one of those, a whole another, like a fractal, yeah. Infinitely down and infinitely up there goes. So you and me, we're two cells on this one organism called a planet that's kind of our God. And yeah. That God is just like one of many, many other little planets and things all strewn throughout, which envelop the one larger consciousness or God called the galaxy. And that galaxy is such and such and blah, 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 all the way up the scale, right? And so the only value I find in any concept of a higher organism is to know that out of all of these infinite possibilities, I'm actually still here. And I get to change things that I see, despite what this God wants. I can actually make things happen. I'm not actually prevented from it. And it means you've got the power to make the world a better place. You've got the power to walk right with God, so to speak.
Well, that's right. That's right. Just because there is an all-pervasive intelligent force does not mean that you lose free will. Unfortunately, the royal political and corporate elite abuse their free will, and they've walked a path of hedonism, indulgence, you know, and ego. And that's very unfortunate.
And I think they've figured out a way to convince everybody else that this kind of power doesn't exist so that they can keep it all for themselves.
Yeah, I mean the so-called Illuminati, which is Latin or Italian for the enlightened ones. These elite groups, you know, that sponsor scientific research and telepathically communicate with the etheric forces and the etheric intelligences, they've always been around, Vinny. You know, I mean, the so-called mystery schools of the Nile, that's what they were. And then you go back to Nineveh, the Assyrians, the Babylonians. You go back 23,000 BC, and I live very close to some prehistoric caves here, where there are cave paintings that date from 23,700 BC. there's always been elite groups. There's always been the people who manipulate, the manipulators. It's very sad, but it's true.
I really hope that we're able to use the technology that we've got access to now.
Yeah.
To, I mean, you were talking about high definition before, right? You know how around the campfire you tell a story to somebody and they'd be a bit pissed or something like that, and they only remember maybe 10% of what you said. It's kind of like old quality cameras zooming in on things and seeing only 10% of what you can see now. Well, I think what's happening with the internet, along with this technology, along with this advancement, is that our thinking can also be accelerated. Our knowledge of things can become far better defined. Yeah. Ergo, it might actually be possible for the first time in goodness knows how many thousands upon thousands of years of human existence to shake off once and for all the scumbaggery parasitic elite that have been governing us at some point or another since the beginning of time.
I 10,000% agree with you, because that is the process which I think we see before us right now with the global people power revolutionary movements. I mean, look at Ukraine. I mean, we're into the fourth week, 1 million people mobilized, huge groups of kids with skateboards and cycles actually following the police home, 4 weeks of rock bands, you know, churning out rock music, deafening the Gestapo police, naked women dancing in fountains, old ladies serving up soup. They've built 20-foot-high sandbag barricades to protect themselves against the Gestapo. There are shipments of logs that are being cut by the agricultural communities in all the villages around Kiev. And those shipments of logs are being delivered to the protesters so that they burn these fires in those squares every night. We're now in the fourth week of the Ukraine People Power Revolution. Ukraine is going to go. The Russian Federation is finished. So much information has come out this last 4 weeks. There is news reports from investigative journalists, and they have revealed or allege that Putin has $40 billion in his personal account. That's about the same as the cash reserves of Apple. Ukraine is going to go, all right? The Russian Federation is dead. Once Ukraine goes, Russia will lose all of its control over its ports into the Black Sea. What does that mean? That means that they will not have naval access to the Middle East any longer, not without asking permission anyway. Once Ukraine goes, I can guarantee it, Vinny, St. Petersburg and Moscow will all break up into their original constituent smaller countries. That federation is dead, and it's dead right now. Putin is not going to last. He's not going to last longer than 18 months. I say, Mr. Putin, if you're listening to this, I recommend you pack your bags, because people have had enough.
You know,
and this is a global, you know, they started calling it the Arab Spring. This is not an Arab Spring. This is a global spring.
And it's ironically happening in the middle of winter.
That's right. In actual fact, if you're going to stage a strike, don't start it in the summer, because everyone gets used to walking around getting a suntan and it's all hot. And as soon as the cold weather comes, everyone breaks up and goes home. The Ukrainian People Power grassroots movement started this deliberately at the coldest time of the year. They're dancing in fountains to rock music in sub-zero temperatures every single night. And they're not going to, you know, they're not going to give up. They want to, basically what it's about is they want to be part of Europe. And now the EU superstate government is corrupt, so I think everyone knows that. But there is a large number of members of the European Parliament who are anti-EU. So this is their plan. Every new state, every new country that joins that EU superstate parliament obviously has to have new members. And some of those members are going to be anti-EU. And so in the end, the entire EU parliament's going to get broken down from the inside. And we will have an end to the crushing of all of these ancient cultures of Europe. And the currencies will come back. And I think that that is inevitable. That is what's going to go on. The people who try and stop this right now are going to be exposed, and they've been exposed. And the next stage after being exposed is to be deposed. And look at Berlusconi. Controls all of those radio stations, controls all those magazines, all those newspapers, all those television stations, and he's been deposed, and he owns his own Masonic lodge. The Pope, who's meant to be personally, if you like, appointed by God Almighty, that's the Pope, has resigned. Chosen by God, but he resigned.
So he chose to resign, even though he was chosen by God. I love that. you know, the fall of the system couldn't happen fast enough. You know, I mean, it's like, that's why I call it the European Union, because they're just pissing on you without the courtesy of calling it a chemtrail.
Yeah. I mean, you know, do me a favor. The European Union isn't even European. There's a part of South America that's part of the EU that uses the euro. It's maybe just a joke.
Maybe it is a joke, because that's why they call it European, because they're just saying that you're a peon.
Yeah. Well, the EU Parliament commissioners meet in secret. They are all former communist Russian bloc leaders. I'll say that again.
Oh, there's a good mixture.
They meet in secret, they decide the policies in secret, and those people are former Kremlin officials.
And it's bound in a blue goat skin book.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. Maybe it is, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the original EU constitution. That's what they had it bound in.
Oh, I think you're right. That's right. I think you are right, yeah.
I mean, look, if there's anybody out there who's got any illusions about good and evil, trust me, evil exists. You know how I know evil exists? Because of bugger all people talking about it. It's like Mark Twain says, if you ever want to figure out what's running society, figure out what you're not allowed to talk about.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about this kind of stuff. Well, we all say that, and it's a great generalization. In fact, there's two of them there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody's talking about it, but we are talking about it right now, aren't we? So in the very process of freaking changing that equation, because I'm really sick and tired, Chris, of people holding back what they think, you know, just being quiet. When reality could be discussed at all freaking times, and it by well should be. I kind of switch off and get bored of listening to people sometimes if it's not interesting enough, you know what I'm saying? If there ain't enough truth, if there ain't enough substance, I'm just like, frack you, I don't care.
Yeah. I think the interesting point you've got there, evil, you're right, it's not actually discussed in these terms, but there is a thread of very suspicious satanic, Luciferian, demonic iconography, which is actually being broadcast in MTV music videos and is on the television. And there's vampires and there's Luciferian symbology in PlayStation games. And what it is that the younger generation especially are actually being bombarded with subconscious representations of very ancient sigils. That's what they're called, sigils and symbols, from voodoo, from Palomayombe voodoo, from Freemasonry, from paganism, from lots of other areas of weird, dark Gnosticism. And that's happening on a second-by-second, minute-by-minute basis. The emphasis in the vampire TV series, I think there's about three vampire big time, you know, prime time series running at the moment, is that it's a TV series with vampires, and obviously there's always going to be next week's episode. And it's like they do evil things, but they never, they are never subjected to any justice.
Yeah.
It's like evil at the end of these horror films, you know, you think the evil has been killed off, and then the last few seconds of the film, there's a cliffhanger, and the evil is still there.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, very similar everywhere you frickin' look, isn't it? You know, and this is why I don't believe in karma, per se, in a large degree, because, you know, if a criminal kills somebody, and then the judge sentences him to jail, right? You say, that's justice. But you don't see a judge going, okay, you're guilty of murder. Go away. Your karma's going to be real bad someday, mate. Oh, pity you. No. You're supposed to punish him. You're supposed to take action. You're supposed to actually bring justice. Justice isn't really a natural state in nature. Like, not every time that a gazelle gets killed, the gazelles mob up and kill the lion that ate their child, right? Doesn't happen. That's the law of the jungle out there. We've got civilization. We can actually do it. And I think all of these great legal systems and media and all of this kind of stuff, all the lies that they're telling us that those things represent, they're actually doing the exact opposite of what they're telling us. So I think that if we could force somehow all of those institutions to do exactly what it is they say they do, the system would actually be frickin' almost perfect.
I think you're right. In actual fact, you're right in what you say, because they are doing the opposite of what they're saying. And, you know, you can play a game, actually. I call it the truth reversal game with the actual TV news. And it's really, it puts a very, very lovely, entertaining edge on watching boring news. And that is that you reverse the meaning of everything that the news reader is telling you. And it's amazing. It's amazing, because when you reverse what they're telling you, that's reality.
Yeah, it's a like satanic inversion. There's kind of like a subconscious thing going on there as well. Imagine if everything you heard was the opposite of the truth. What would you make of the truth? You'd think the truth was insane, wouldn't you? And then, boom, you got I had a profound realization the other day, Chris, because people like think I'm a conspiracy theorist and all of that kind of stuff. You know how you can't say the N-word to black people anymore? You can't diss a woman or be anti-feminist or anything like that without somebody reprimanding you? You can't smoke a cigarette without somebody giving you crap about it. But the thing is, you can be a conspiracy theorist, allegedly, and you just watch people back away. It doesn't happen when you come up and you say, I'm black, or I'm a woman, or I'm a cigarette smoker. We're now officially, as far as I'm concerned, the most discriminated against group of fracks on the planet Earth, because people are totally afraid of the information and think that we're completely insane.
Well, that's true. But I think that if you can imagine a pendulum, it's actually swinging now. I mean, people can actually see the corruption. People have become completely disillusioned with the political class, all these politicians claiming bloody expenses, you know, into the millions and all this kind of thing. That cuts deep. You know, especially with the working classes who, you know, basically skimp along, and they have huge amounts of tax actually stolen from their wage packets even before they get their hands on their wage packets. And we've seen a total breakdown of confidence in the political class. You know, people just see it now. And, you know,
the problem is they become very, very big. They become apathetic rather than active.
The what?
They become apathetic rather than active, though. It's the incorrect response.
I'm not too sure about that. I think that there are more and more people who realize that politicians are corrupt. They may not go out onto the streets doing demonstrations, but I can tell you this. And I give a lot of speeches. I was down in Barcelona giving speeches to the May 15th revolutionary movement on the streets there, and I've done that many times. I was at the poll tax riots, you know, in the middle of London years ago. And, you know, I believe that for every single person that's out there on the streets, like there's teachers out on the streets in Mexico right now, there's people who are on the streets in Tokyo, there's people on the streets in Hong Kong now who want the communist puppet governor taken away. For every single one of those people that's out on the streets, there's another 10,000 people at home saying, go on, you know, go on. And they have support. That is for sure happening.
You're absolutely correct. And one thing that frustrates me is when people say, oh, predict the future, tell us the future, right? As if you're ever actually going to see it. Because even if you did see it, it'd be right now. You know what I'm saying? And also another thing, don't tell us about the problems. Tell us about the solutions. Bro, if you even knew how bad the problems were, okay, you wouldn't actually be half as motivated as I am to actually look for a solution. You know? The more of a problem you see, the more you would see the urgency for a solution to this problem. And as we mentioned earlier, I think we come up with two relatively important points here, is that that Venus Project sort of idea with the resource-based economy would be great. And in order to achieve that, and this is the thing that the Zeitgeist doesn't really look at, is how to actually remove the scumbaggery from power. And and in so doing, all we're going to do is have a look at all of these institutions that are allegedly supposed to be responsible, that are doing the exact opposite of what they're doing, and just force them to make their lives, make their lies real again.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I am an optimist, Vinny. I'm, you know, all these things that we've been discussing on this show, we've discussed some, you know, the aspects of evil and things, but I am an optimist. And like I say, Ukraine is going to be the trigger, and we're going to see a complete breakup of this fake Russian Federation. And also in the Arabian world, where you've got 44 countries, which are all part of, you know, this Arabian Islamic kind of arrangement, we are going to see, and we're already seeing Turkey wants a change. 33 million Egyptian people went onto the streets in August, and they cleared the desks of the fake Muslim Brotherhood. Now, just a few days ago, a 247-point new constitution was brought into Egypt, and one of the points in that constitution is the banning of religious political parties, and everyone was whooping with happiness about that, because that's how the Muslim Brotherhood were basically shoehorned into power.
Yeah, they're practically a CIA offshoot.
Absolutely. I mean, they were funded by different factions that are kind of friendly with the high-up echelons of Sudanese society. Sudan shares the southern border with Egypt. Sudan was actually British, the same as Egypt. I mean, Egypt was British right up until 1953, and Sudan was under British rule as well. And Malik Obama is the half-brother of Barack Obama, and he's friends with the president of Sudan, and the president of Sudan has been cited by the International Criminal Court at The Hague. And they're saying this guy is a bad dude, and he's like more or less good friends with Obama's half-brother. Obama's half-brother has been cited by elements of the independent Arabian press as being kind of friends with all kinds of people. And some of those have been accused, or it's been alleged, that they supplied bullets, ammunition, guns for the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's all been found out. I mean, the chemical weapons in Syria, this is turning the clock back just a few weeks ago, those chemical weapons were made from fluoride. And that fluoride was manufactured by British companies. And it was shipped to Syria. And it was shipped with the full knowledge of the Department of Trade and Industry, with a nod and a wink from Her Majesty's Customs and Excise. That whole Syrian situation is a scam, which we exposed.
Well, it's a scam, and it's also a very serious situation. And for the people who get attacked by fluoride, it's very Assad.
Yeah. Yeah. And now what they're doing with the so-called chemical weapons is, you know, they couldn't start a war because engineering wars is what they do. It's how they make their money. That's traditionally how the Illuminati make their money, is war.
Well, financing and, both sides of it and selling the weapons to both sides of it anyway.
That's right. Well, what they do is they set two sides into conflict with each other, and they break down the actual infrastructure of the civilization in both of those entities, both those nations. And once they've broken down the infrastructure, they are then free to just walk through the door, as it were, take the oil, the diamonds, the gold, the platinum, the uranium, water. And, of course, the Arabian countries that are in the heart of the Middle East, regardless of whether the oil lasts or whether it runs out, it doesn't matter. For those Middle Eastern countries, they are always going to be rich in energy, because when the oil runs out, they are rich in solar power. And that is why Iran, Iraq, and other Middle Eastern countries are on this invade and rule list, which was exposed by a Pentagon general just a few weeks ago, where he said that they had some amazing plan, which is to take over, I think it was 5 countries in 7 years or 7 countries in 5 years. Just amazing. And the Middle East is rich in solar power. It really doesn't matter whether the oil lasts or not. It's still going to be strategically valuable to the elite.
Mm. And, of course, think about geopolitical control. If you wanted to do proxy wars against Russia or China or pit it against the West or AFRICOM or anything like that, what is the intersecting point of all of those particular plans? Where would you need all of your bases in order to fight any of those conflicts?
Well, that's right. Absolutely. And we know, obviously, that the Pentagon have actually given huge amounts of money to these groups that are meant to be the adversaries.
They're funding Al-Qaeda. They're even officially backing Al-Qaeda in Syria.
And also the Taliban as well. The Taliban actually had a delegation in Washington. They met with Colin Powell. There's footage of this. This is not a conspiracy theory. If you just stumbled on this broadcast, this is absolutely true. It's verifiable. The word Taliban, do you know what the word Taliban means, Vinny?
To ban television.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, no. Taliban. No, it doesn't mean ban TV. A Taliban means student. That's what it means. And Al-Qaeda, that's a slang term. If you're sitting on the toilet and somebody opens the toilet door, you shout out, Al-Qaeda. It means, excuse me, I'm sitting on the toilet. Or there's another colloquial meaning, which is like a base camp or the base tent of a camp. That's what Al-Qaeda is.
So the base tent, all right, okay. And this whole breakdown that some people have made, calling it the database, like of the names of their operatives of the Mujahideen by the CIA in the 80s?
Well, yeah. Does that have any validity? Let's face it. The Mujahideen were only who were they? They were just farmers. They were in the Afghan hills, and they were doing their thing, growing their opium and their crops and things. And then a load of Russian planes fly over. I mean, it was, the Romanov royals, who are still around to this day, by the way, who decided to invade, or they thought that they could absorb Afghanistan and its opium into Russia. And Buckingham Palace said, no way, you know. I mean, the Romanov royal family is the same family as the British royal family. There's no question about that. The Romanovs are the same family as the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas. That's the actual real name of the so-called British royal family.
And don't they all trace back to Vlad the Impaler anyway?
A trace back to where?
Vlad the Impaler.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, they do. Vlad the Impaler, the Bathory family, they were other bloodthirsty people. They go all the way back to... They claim descent from the House of David and King Solomon. And King Solomon is one of the... He's the most important character in the rituals of Freemasonry, yeah.
Mm. Well, this is one of those harsh realities that you've got to deal with, that life ain't all sunshine and rainbows, that there are things that go bump in the night. And sometimes you've got to just kind of bump back.
Yeah, that's what the people in Mexico, Brazil, Turkey, Hong Kong, Ukraine, Portugal. I mean, seriously, there might even be something kicking off in Ireland. There's going to be a lot of government regime changes happening over the next 18 months.
Let's hope they don't get co-opted, because this is something that was very encouraging for me to see in Egypt. First they have that revolution, then they then it gets co-opted by the Muslim Brotherhood, but then they enforce their will and get them out. Same thing happened in Iceland. They got the government out, then they got the government in that they wanted, then a whole bunch of bankers got involved, and then they kicked them out. And it is like the Founding Father said, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Don't turn your back for a second. That's when they'll take you. Yeah. That's when they'll slip the knife in your ribs.
Yeah, we now are very aware. We are very aware of this scam that goes on when you get a grassroots revolutionary movement. We know now that they install puppet regimes. So it's amazing. We've gone past that now. People scrutinize these governments that are put in. A look at Thailand. That's fascinating. The riot police actually laid down their shields and truncheons and stood with the people and actually moved the barricades. And now they're actually forming a people power parliament in Thailand. Because the government of Thailand that they had was a fake government that was put in the last time that the people complained. So we know this tactic, we know it all very well now. There's nothing really they can do about it.
Yeah, it's much like a snake oil scam. Imagine just before a snake oil salesman rolls into your town and says, "This will cure your baldness, it'll take away your excess weight." And little does he know, the day before, somebody's come through the town going, "Bro, there's a snake oil salesman that scammed our entire township and robbed us all blind."
Yeah.
So he's talking to a crowd of people who know that he's full of it. That is the day that I dream to see, where one of these New World Order puppet faceless suits full of scumbaggery and malice and cruelty get shouted down for every vile word of venom that they spout to the crowds of people listening.
Well, that's already happened. I mean, that is happening. And look at Ceausescu. They shouted him down, dragged him around the back and shot him and his wife through the head. I mean, it is already happening, and the elite know it. And the writing's been on the wall for a long time.
Are they afraid? And if so, we've talked about a lot of our ancient technologies we've talked about a lot of evil and we've talked about a lot of scumbaggery. Just think about what would they be capable of when they're absolutely scared to death. Like, the old adage of cornering a wild animal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is where we're getting now. We're going to have to be very, very careful, because they've got some nasty things up their sleeves. When they get cornered, they do very terrible things. One of the things that they've got obviously up their sleeve, and it's no secret, is pandemics and plagues. And this has probably been used in the past, I believe.
Mm,
mm. Smallpox, they actually killed a lot of the Native American Indians by giving them blankets that were already infected with smallpox.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that they do. So we have to be prepared.
Well, and again, vigilant. What we've seen in more recent times is whistleblowers in increasing numbers coming forth, blocking things from happening, delaying agendas, in some cases permanently. It's kind of like... Yeah. It really is sort of the tortoise and the hare, you know. You know how the tortoise is one of the symbols used by Fabian socialism. You want to change everything very gradually. A tortoise wielding a hammer, so that you move along very, very gradually, and then you give the killing blow with the hammer. That's the New World Order in a nutshell, or a turtle shell, as maybe. And we're the hare. We've been sleeping for a long time, and now we're racing towards the finish line, trying to catch up with this turtle that was beating us.
Yeah. I think that, well, the internet is obviously playing a big role. I think the thing that they're doing now is that they're garden walling the information that you can get on the internet. And that's pretty obvious. So independent websites that broadcast investigative journalism, when you go to those websites, it'll probably take 10, 12, 15 minutes for that website to actually load. Whereas when you go and do, you know, you want to buy your you know, Pop-Tarts and your TV dinners, and you want to order those online, that'll just, you know, it'll load up in 2 seconds flat. Mm-hmm. That's what is basically what I think is going to go on.
Now, this is the reason why you're an optimist, isn't it? Because you know that it's not hopeless. In fact, somebody asked me. Somebody asked me yesterday. I really want to share this with you. Actually, I want to know what you think. He said, "Vinny, do you think this country's like meaning New Zealand? Do you think this country's totally fracked?" And something occurred to me is, have you read Sun Tzu's The Art of War?
Yes, I have. Yes.
There's a story within it where Sun Tzu's army is surrounded on all sides, and they're basically dead, right? So what he does is he orders all the food and water to be destroyed. and suddenly his troops realize there's no escape. You're all surrounded. There's no food or water. So even if you did survive, you'd starve to death. We're at the brink of death. The only way to survive is to go through this enemy, right? When all hope is lost, that is when hope springs eternal. Isn't it ironic?
Mm.
And he successfully fought and defeated the enemy and lost a minimal amount of his men due to the motivation.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the Art of War, Sun Tzu, is one of the most popular books in Wall Street. And if you look at the movie Wall Street, you can actually see Gordon Gekko has a copy of that on his desk.
Mm. This is true. And I think what's really important about this is that skills are skills. You know, you can wield a hammer and you could either build a great architectural design or you could kill somebody with it. Right?
Yeah.
They're all tools in the hands of the wielder.
Yeah, that's it. That's very true.
And that's where perception actually does really take hold. Realities are realities, but perceptions can help you shape it, change it, do different things with it, interpret it in ways other people maybe haven't before, and come up with something freaking original. Because I don't know about you, but I'm really, 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 really getting tired of 7 different sequels for a movie that was crap in the first place.
Yeah, that's very true. There is a lack of ideas in the mainstream media. There's no question about that. I think that's because they shut out independent creative people and they try and run a closed shop. And therefore they're relying on comic books and they're making comic books into movies, and they're relying on video games and they're making video games into movies. They seem to be recycling existing stuff, you know.
It's boring. It's freaking boring. It's predictable. What is that word? It's banality.
Yeah.
I think they call it banality because it's the bane of creative people.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Chris, I'm sure it must be late where you are and what have you.
Yes, it's 3 a.m. here.
Yeah, sweet. It's 3 p.m. here.
Oh, that's amazing. So it's a 12-hour difference. I suppose it must be.
Exactly.
That's fascinating, isn't it? That means we're actually almost exactly on opposite sides of the planet.
Exactly.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, I've enjoyed it, Vinny. You know, I wish you well with your show. I watched a couple of snippets of your interviews, and I think that you'd be very popular with the viewers of the Enigma channel.
Oh, really?
I think they'd really like you, yeah. And people are genuinely interested in New Zealand. They're very interested in the Maori. They're very interested in the Polynesians. And that kind of thing would go down very well. And thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's been an honour and a pleasure and about 17 other nice adjectives that I'm just you know, it's been wonderful, mate. And we will have all of this up, ladies and gentlemen, for you on the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. Chris Everard's websites are ChristopherEverard.com. Like, that's ever, and then Ard, because he's an Ard man.
There you go. .com.
And ever so
and
hard.
People can get a free view account at the Enigma channel. That's enigmatv.com.
Well, can I upload my videos there or something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, come on board as a member of the team.
Oh, sweet, mate. I think I'll take you up on that, actually. Yes.
Okay, Vinny.
Cool, mate.
All right, then. You take care and stay in touch, won't you?
Indeed. All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Cheers.
Bye.